This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to transactional banking with simple, transparent fees.
It's Wednesday, the 19th of February, and this is your BizNews briefing. In our lead story, we speak to Neil Diamond, who is the SA president of the SA Chamber of Commerce in the US. And we ask him about the letter that four Congress members have written to President Trump, strongly urging them to cut diplomatic ties with South Africa and further to exit South Africa from AGOA.
From the South African Chamber of Commerce side, we've kind of found ourselves in an uncomfortable position in this whole event. It's our responsibility to share information with our members that would assist them in navigating the economic realities between South Africa and the US. We have seen this letter that was written on February the 11th by four prominent members of Congress. This included some of the more senior members of Congress that have had South Africa on their radar for a while. And it basically urges the White House, specifically President Trump, to review the relationship with South Africa with a focus of removing South Africa in AGOA and using very firm language in as far as that South Africa does not qualify to continue as a participant in AGOA. There are a lot of peripheral political issues that have been referenced in the letter as well that I don't necessarily want to get involved in, but I think the impact on business is severe. And at this stage, it's getting to a new low in the overall relationship. But the amount of voices on the periphery that is starting to participate in the discussion really makes this a group chat in opposed to a two-way discussion between our nation's leaders that we as the chamber have been calling for and have been requesting the South African government to reach out to the US. That has happened, but it seems like there's a bit of a cold shoulder from the White House in responding to the request of the South African government.
And that's what we've heard on the ground, is that the meeting requests have actually not met favorably and have not come to fruition with President Trump. Can you confirm that?
Well, our information is at this stage that a lot is happening in the Trump administration in as far as the global relationship of the U.S. with various partners. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has been traveling the Gulf, visiting various Arab nations. So I don't necessarily think it's a matter of not responding to South Africa. It's rather a matter of South Africa not really being as high on the agenda as we would have liked to see. President Trump this week announced the fair trade and tariff regulations, where he's imposing the same tariffs that nations impose on the US, reciprocating on those tariffs. We've seen action being taken at NATO this week, where the US just said, we cannot carry the defense budget of NATO any longer. European nations need to step up to the plate. Very much aligned to the narrative that we saw with African nations, where the US said, USAID and Prosper Africa cannot continue carrying African nations and all their needs and wants. It's unfortunate, and it left a gaping hole in many countries in the delivery of certain much-needed services. But at the same time, we need to respect that the U.S. president acts in the interest of the United States, and that is what the U.S. president has done in this case. Has it affected South Africa? Absolutely. But we need to continue pushing to at least ensure that there's some dialogue, a continuation of dialogue. And what we are hearing out of all the other voices is not assisting us.
Where to from here, Neil? I mean, can we walk back the situation?
I think any relationship can be repaired. Every single day in the globe, there are diplomatic crises. And for those of us that enjoyed the TV series, Madam Secretary, that was one drama after the next every single episode. So it gives you an insight into what kind of global drama unfolds on a daily basis. For us, we see the South African scenario very serious. It's on top of our agenda. It's something we talk about. It's something that our members want more information about. But I think for the US, South Africa is just one of the host of countries that they have identified where the relationship is not where they would fully like it to be. And in that basis, the chamber has continually encouraged our Minister of International Relations, Ronald Lamola, and our president to reach out to the White House. And we've got full confidence that if a discussion takes place between those leaders, between Ronald Lamola and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and between Cyril Ramaphosa and President Donald Trump, that they could smooth things over. South Africa cannot afford to be excluded out of AGOA. But all these other voices, both on the South African side and on the US side, is not contributing to the solution.
That full interview with Neil Diamond is available on biznews.tv on our YouTube platform. Now, yesterday we also spoke of the story that had surfaced around Minister of Mineral and Petroleum Resources Gwede Mantashe's statement that South Africa would pursue energy deals, nuclear energy deals with the likes of Iran and Russia, and would not exclude anyone from coming to the table. I caught up with Andrew Kenny, who is a highly specialized intellect in the nuclear space. He has a physics degree, mechanics degree, engineering degree. He's worked at Kuberg and also at Eskom. And this is what he had to say with regards to the situation. And listen carefully to what he says about Iran's potential to provide nuclear energy in the first place.
This is a very, very unfortunate matter. And there's been stupidity from both sides. So just to be blunt about it, I actually would have voted for Trump if I was an American. But I'm very disappointed and think he's done a whole lot of stupid things. For example, he's let down his own court. For example, our Expropriation Act is terrible. It's a threat to property, but it's not what he says it is. It's nothing to do with singling out Afrikaans farmers or that. That's a load of nonsense. So he's talking nonsense there. Now here, for some reason, he said, I'm reading what he said. This is Trump with one of his executive orders. Is accusing South Africa of reinvigorating its relations with Iran to develop commercial, military, and nuclear arrangements. This is complete nonsense. First of all, we've got nothing to do with nuclear weapons at all. In fact, we're the moral leaders of the world as far as nuclear weapons are concerned. We had them and renounced them. We're open to full inspection from the whole world. Anyone can come examine our thing. We are not making nuclear weapons. We're not going to. With Iran, we haven't got any relationships with Iran and nuclear at all, with power, not nothing. So Mantashe is quite right when he said we haven't got any sort of relations with them on nuclear. And our nuclear energy of South corporations has said the same thing, nothing. And why should we have? We're ahead of Iran as far as nuclear technology is concerned. We've got nothing. Okay, but now, unfortunately, Mantashe got a bit aggressive himself. He didn't quite say we won't be bullied, as Ramaphosa said, which was a stupid thing to say because actually allows himself to be bullied the whole time. But he said we will accept bids from anyone around the world as far as nuclear power is concerned. Well, quite right, too, that when we do go out to bid on a nuclear power station, which I hope is very soon, it's been far too long in coming, of course we accept bids from anyone in the world without exception. So Russia, of course. In fact, I'll be honest with you, I think if I was going wanting a nuclear power station for anyone in the world, I think the Russians offer the best ones that there are. Wonderful, they're safe, they're good, etc. Iran offers nothing. We're ahead of them. So this is a really stupid confrontation between us. It shouldn't be a confrontation at all. There's nothing to argue about.
And staying with the nuclear theme, our colleagues at the Financial Times are reporting that developers of small nuclear modular reactors are being favorably received by investors, having raised up to $1.5 billion from tech companies. Let's take a listen.
Developers of small nuclear reactors are enjoying something of an investment boom. They've raised over $1.5 billion in the past year as money pours in from big tech and elsewhere. Jamie Smith is the FT's U.S. energy editor, and he's been totaling up the figures. Hi, Jamie.
Hello, Mark.
All right, so Jamie, what's been going on in this space?
So, Mark, yeah, when I first started covering the small modular reactor sector about a year and a half ago, we were actually in a bit of a funding drought for these companies. High inflation, high interest rates was really hitting the sector quite hard. But what we've seen over the past year is there's been this flow of money back into these new technologies. So in total, we've got about $1.5 billion raised from this new type of development over the past 12 months.
Let's back up for a second. What exactly are mini nuclear reactors, these SMRs, and why all the interest?
So SMRs stand for small modular reactors. They're a new class of smaller, more compact nuclear reactors that use nuclear fission to generate heat and power. Typically, they generate about a third of the power produced by one of the standard full-scale nuclear power plants. Now, they're really growing in popularity because they can be made more cheaply and with less risk than the massive nuclear reactors that have typically been built over the last several decades.
So clearly there's an appeal there. What would a revival in the nuclear sector do to the larger main energy sector?
Well, at the minute in the US, nuclear provides about 18 to 20% of the electricity into the energy mix. What we're seeing is that the electricity demand in the US is really surging at the minute, in particular because of the rollout of internet data centers to power this artificial intelligence boom. So SMRs are seen as a key way to plug that gap. You know, one of the big drivers for the increased funding into SMRs is that last October, Google signed a power supply deal with Kairos Power, and Amazon signed a big power supply deal with X-Energy. These two deals really demonstrated, I think, that the big tech companies really see nuclear as a viable way to supply them with power to fuel this artificial intelligence boom.
Jamie, this sounds all well and good, but I have to assume that there might be some risks to this kind of investment.
Exactly. SMRs are really a first-of-a-kind technology deployment. Now, that brings with it huge technical and regulatory risks. So a lot of these are innovative technologies. Some of them might not work, for example. Also, regulators, particularly with nuclear energy, they've got to be very careful. This can delay deployment of these type of technologies. Then separately, despite this increase in funding that we're seeing over the last year, these technologies still rely a lot on government investment. So the Biden administration offered co-development grants to X-Energy and TerraPower of over $1 billion each. Also, the IRA, Biden's flagship climate law, provided production tax breaks of up to 50% for these SMRs. Now, Trump, although he does seem to be a fan of nuclear power, has taken issue with the amount of money going towards the IRA. So there is a risk that Trump could cut the funding for these types of projects, and that would obviously have a devastating impact on their rollout.
Jamie Smith is the FT's US energy editor. Thanks so much, Jamie.
Thanks, Mark.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
At SunExchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
The South African budget is being tabled in Parliament today, and I spoke to George Glinos, who is a well-respected economist in the South African landscape, to get his thoughts on what we should look out for in today's budgets, especially if there may be some surprises in his opinion, on the way.
Well, Bronwyn, expectations are running quite high because it wasn't long ago in Davos that Finance Minister Gordhan Gwanah indicated that he thinks that he can get South Africa back into investment grade within a couple of years, which in itself is a very exciting prospect because it means that we will have had to have done a lot of things right in a fairly short space of time. So if you had to ask that question differently and ask me, what is it that we need to do in that short space of time, excuse me, to get the South African credit rating back up into investment grade, I would say, given the lack of fiscal space that currently exists that the authorities have to work with, that they need to rely more heavily on the private sector. And so what I'm hoping for out of this budget is that we get some sense of by this government of national unity that they are inclined to liberalize a number of network industries, that they are prepared to encourage the private sector to do a lot of investment into those network industries, and that ultimately that they are going to take up the heavy burden of capital investment and then running those utilities in a way that we haven't seen for a number of decades now. So that's what I'm hoping for. But like I said, the fiscal room that they have to work with is quite constrained at this stage of the game. So it's questionable whether they are going to want to make the sacrifices needed in order to redirect spending away from just social spending towards things like infrastructure and capital investment and the private sector. But ultimately, that's what they need to do.
George, are you expecting any surprises to the negative?
I mean, it's always possible. I'm hoping that given this government of national unity and that there seem to be more checks and balances within the political framework to make sure that everyone's playing their part and that the level of patronage and corruption is reduced substantially, that the element of a negative surprise will be limited. If you had to ask me what kind of negative surprise could spring up, it's difficult to tell at this stage. Maybe the numbers come in worse than expected, although that's not what I'm anticipating. I think the numbers actually could come in slightly better than expected. Could they carry on with things like the NHI, which we think is unaffordable for this country? Potentially. But I'm seeing the scope for negative surprises this time around being reduced. Expectations are far higher for this budget than I've encountered for many, many years now. And it's partly because we're dealing with a new political dispensation whose makeup is different. And I think that has encouraged a lot of optimism, and that optimism now needs to find expression in real action. And so it's over to the government to give us some idea of how they're going to justify that optimism.
Staying with the budget, Stan Libs' Kevin Lings talks to us about expectations specifically on what changes we may see on the VAT line.
So I think there's very little room for big surprises because of two major constraints. The first is the government has way too much debt. The debt level is up at 75% of GDP. The minister can't really allow that to go substantially higher than where it is now. If he did that, obviously there would be a price to pay in terms of bond yields would move higher. In other words, the cost of debt would go up. The credit rating agencies would view that very badly. And so I think he's capped in terms of his debt level. And that places a major constraint on what the government is able to do and get involved in, particularly when you think about bailing out SOEs. All of that puts a huge strain on government's balance sheet. And so it takes away a lot of optionality. The second constraint is that you're in a growth rate of 1%. So when you're growing at 1%, you're not creating a phenomenal number of formal sector jobs. You're not expanding the tax base. And so your revenue is effectively then pegged. And you can't do a hell of a lot if you government with a stagnant revenue base and a high level of debt. And so that ultimately constrains what he can do. What he should do, obviously, is improve government efficiency massively. If I look at what Elon Musk is achieving within the U.S. fiscal system, the amount of wasted expenditure that he can uncover there, South Africa must have tenfold of that. And therefore, there would be huge gains that you can make in terms of making government much more effective, much more efficient. I'm not sure they're going to do that. Obviously, they're going to continue on with the social payments, social grants. There is a suggestion about increasing VAT as a way to raise some revenue, and then a zero
could we
rate.
Pause there? What increase could happen in the VAT spectrum?
So you could increase about 1%, take it to 16%. That would raise a significant amount of money for you. But then you would have to give something back. And what you could give back is to zero rate more items. And you could then argue that you're going to increase the social relief of distress grant on top of that to provide a buffer for the poorer segment of the South African population. And maybe you get away with it, but it would be very unpopular because the segment that is paying the bulk of the income tax in South Africa is under enormous strain. And there's no doubt that you would put an additional burden on the South African economy. But that's the sort of suggestion that reflects the fact that we don't have this flexibility and we don't have very high growth rates. We don't have employment growth rates. In terms of the other taxes, I'm hoping he provides some tax relief for individuals in terms of fiscal drag. Last year, he did nothing for fiscal drag. That hurts the consumer, so I'm hoping he does at least some of the fiscal drag effect. In other words, to give us some relief because of the negative impact of inflation. I don't think he changes corporate taxes. And in terms of the other major taxes, I'm not expecting much change. I think he will tinker with some of the excise duties, alcohol, tobacco, cigarettes. Maybe he looks at the road accident fund. I think he leaves the fuel levy alone. So there are a couple of things he can play with, but in truth, it's not going to amount to a huge amount. The focus is on the expenditure side. Can you reprioritize? Can you increase infrastructure spending and take away from consumption spending? That would be very good. Are you going to provide a lot more money to Transnet? I'm hoping not, because they are in the process of a reform and you would want to see that reform go a lot further before you hand over money. But what are you going to do about the other SOEs, post office, etc.? So there's a big gap in terms of the SOE funding. So what I would be hoping is that minimal tax changes, focus on the expenditure, focus on trying to up infrastructure, focus on any initiative that lifts growth.
Our colleagues at the Financial Times are reporting that the US and Russia have laid the groundwork for future cooperation to end the Ukraine war. There's also much speculation that Donald Trump has his eyes on Ukraine's mineral deposits.
President Donald Trump is after Ukraine's rare and precious metals. His administration is floating a plan that would give the U.S. a stake in the country's vast natural resources. But it raises some questions. My colleague Chris Miller has been looking into this from Kyiv. He joins me now. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Mark.
All right, so let's start with what minerals does Ukraine have that Trump is so interested in?
Sure. Well, Ukraine actually has quite a few minerals. These include things like lithium, graphite, cobalt, titanium. So titanium, for example, is used for missiles, planes, ship production. Ukraine is also rich in coal. So these are all things that can be used in American production facilities, for example, and have attracted the Trump administration.
Yeah. And how did Trump even get wind of these minerals? How do you find out?
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. You know, one of his allies, Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, first turned both Trump onto this idea and the Ukrainians onto the idea that it might be something that attracts Trump. And so last summer, the Ukrainians started drafting what President Zelensky calls his victory plan. And when he came to the United States in September of last year, he met with Donald Trump in New York, and he presented this victory plan to him. And one of those points was this idea of swapping American military assistance for access to Ukraine's rare and critical minerals. That was something that Trump really liked. And when he was elected in November, the Ukrainians started discussing how they could present that to him in a way in which they could secure future military assistance from the United States under the Trump administration.
Okay, so there's very clearly this thing that the Trump administration wants from Ukraine. What is Trump offering Ukraine in return?
Yeah, and it turns out actually not very much. Trump has said that he would like to recoup around $500 billion that he thinks is owed to the United States for past support for Ukraine's defenses. Ukrainian officials that I spoke to over the weekend were telling me, you know, that actually this deal that they offered us, it is a document that lays out that Ukraine is to give roughly 50% of all of its rare and critical minerals that could be mined and future earnings to the United States in return for this military assistance that was already given to Ukraine under the Biden administration. So it's actually an offer for Trump to take everything and give very little, if anything, in return. And for the Ukrainians, that's just not an option.
Chris, I guess I'm just wondering, though, how feasible is this plan to begin with? This is a country at war, obviously. So is it going to be hard to get these projects off the ground and actually extract these minerals that we're talking about?
Well, according to experts and Ukrainian officials, it's going to be really difficult and time-consuming and very costly. They don't expect these minerals to be extracted for many years, if not decades. There are some open mines that are in production here in Ukraine, but many of them have been occupied by Russian forces over the last 3 or 10 years when Russia's invasion first began. Many of the others are still really sitting there in deposits under the earth. So this is a really difficult and very timely and costly process that we're talking about.
Chris, to what extent do you think a deal would be good for Ukraine?
Well, the deal as is not good for Ukraine. And Ukrainian officials, including President Volodymyr Zelensky, have been very vocal about that. So one of the things that the Zelensky team has told me is that they're trying to renegotiate this offer and trying to tie directly into the agreement future American military assistance. And actually, some people here in Kyiv and some Western officials have said the Ukrainians might have made a mistake in offering this too quickly and without enough thought. They say that Zelensky should have been a bit more specific about what he was willing to give up to the Americans in exchange for military assistance.
That's the FT's Chris Miller in Ukraine. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Mark.
Right now, all economists are in lockdown with the South African finance minister, Enoch Godongwana. Once they come out of lockdown at round about 1 o'clock, we will start engaging with economists on the ground to get more detail on what actually transpired at the budget. So look out for that coverage on biznews.tv on YouTube. Thanks for joining us for this BizNews briefing. As always, we appreciate your time.
This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to finance solutions that enable real growth.